This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 21st of January, 1961. The title of this lecture is Opening Lecture. This lecture is 53 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And welcome here to the first South African Congress that I've given. The history of Scientology here in South Africa now is getting many years old, right? It's about time we had a Congress that I gave, huh? But simultaneously, this very well may be one of the last Congresses I ever give. I'm getting too busy. The difficulties in giving congresses are represented by the fact that our comm lines are now just a little bit too long. Do you know that in the past 3 weeks I have flown, let me see now, it's about 20,000 miles. I've given a Congress, given an ACC, straightened out three central organizations. Pretty wild, huh? And here I am giving you a Congress. So if I drop dead up here, would some able Scientologist jump up on the stage and tell me to come back and pick up that mock-up and continue this Congress? The difficulties of giving a Congress, of course, have to do with the fact that they're exactly on schedule. And we never are. Now, frankly speaking, the number of times that I've given Congresses now, they're always coming in the middle of a flap. There's always some tremendous flap occurring of one kind or another. And the world is a very big place, and it's a very aberrated place. And here and there throughout the world, they're having trouble. Have you noticed that? Probably the only place in the world there's no trouble is the Union of South Africa. Now, here in South Africa, it's all calm. You got everything cool and collected. When they start throwing around the A-bombs, well, they're going to go across back and forth in the Northern Hemisphere. And if you're smart enough to stay out of the situation where you yourself are connected with the A-bomb-throwing people, well, you'll just sit here and be the last civilization on Earth, that's all. And then we can take off from here and go back and put them back together again. And that's what I mean by saying we're just a little bit late. We're just a little bit late in Scientology. Long, long time ago, I was in a university called George Washington University over in the United States, Washington, D.C., I was studying nuclear physics, and I said, well, the best thing to do is just to go on and study nuclear physics because my father wants me to. That's a good reason. And when I finally get through studying nuclear physics, why, I'll write for a living. And that's the way it worked out, because nobody wanted a nuclear physicist in 1934. Nobody had anything to do with a nuclear physicist in 1934. We were the Buck Rogers boys. We could make things go whir, clank, and split atoms. And we didn't know that a chap named Einstein would sooner or later write a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and say to Franklin, he'd say to him, Dear Franklin, we can build a gimmick which wipes out whole cities. Now look. Well, the second they started to build this gimmick, they recruited every nuclear physicist in the world. They said to the nuclear physicist, now, you had better rally round and join the Manhattan Project, and we know there's just a few of you boys who are not employed in nuclear physics at the moment, and we're going to employ you, and everything's going to be fine. And they came around and asked me about it, and I said, what do you think I said? I said, you're going to build a bomb. And they said, who told you? I said, a little bird back in 1934. And they said, well, aren't you going to help us build this bomb? Why don't you be a patriotic person and wipe out mankind with the rest of us? I was already a member of naval forces. It was very easy for them to say, you know, they send you greetings. Over in the United States, they send you greetings and you appear in a uniform. It's a materialization. And I said, no, I didn't want anything to do with this project. So they said, well, we've got orders for you. We got orders for you to Manila. A war is about to break out and you're going to Manila. So I said, okay. The war broke out, and I never got to Manila. But for the next 3 or 4 years, I was busy. Every time I came back, somebody was liable to say to me something on the order of, wouldn't you like to join the Manhattan Project? I'd say, no. They'd say, well, we've got orders for you to the next combat theater. That's the way it went. They had a lot of combat theaters by that time. Did you know that? They didn't ever run out of them. I almost ran out of me a couple of times. But anyway, all due respects to atomic fission, it was pretty obvious that we were going to have trouble. And in 1932, I began to work on the subject in which you're interested. And I began to work on that in a very peculiar way. I found out that all poetry of the world described the same graph on a Kinnick photometer. Isn't that an interesting start? You didn't know your origin was poetry, did you? Poetry, what did an engineer have to do with poetry? Well, that's what everybody else wanted to know. Why? What are you fooling around with poetry for? All poetry, in other words, has the same cadences. And these cadences are each and every one of them a duplicate on a Kinnick photometer. So no matter what his race, color, or creed, it was obvious that men responded in the same way to poetry. And that, to me, was an important fact. Many years before this time, I had already studied psychoanalysis. My best friend in those days was Commander Snake Thompson, who had personally studied with Sigmund Freud, and although I was pretty young, he filled me up to the ears with association and tokens and all this sort of thing, ids and libidos. My goodness, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I got so, however, that I could understand why everybody was crazy. Well, as time went on, I got out in the Orient, and I began to listen to what the people were doing out there, and I found out they weren't getting along so well, but they certainly knew an awful lot about spiritualism and reading the future, and, well, I don't know. If we had some time, I could even show you an Indian rope trick, but I won't. Since the mechanics of it consist of hypnotizing the whole audience. And you look like you're happy already. The last time, by the way, that I used hypnotism was a very notable and interesting experiment. I couldn't resist it. Psychiatry in the United States in the early days of Dianetics and Scientology was tremendously interested in the subject. They thought it was a marvelous, marvelous subject. That was before they found out it ruined their pocketbooks. It's true, when they take it up, you know, they get rid of their practices. They cure everybody. And then they've got no practice left, and so it's not possible. It's not popular. You think I'm joking, but one of the leading psychoanalysts of England was a Dianeticist for a very long time and then had to quit it because it was breaking him. He had to spend so much time going out and getting new practices all the time. Sounds ridiculous, isn't it? What they do is get a few people, evidently, who are very aberrated and have a checkbook. Anyway, though, that's an unkind remark. I'm sorry. I apologize to anybody who was particularly interested in this field. And as a matter of fact, I'll make better on the thing by inviting him to come over and take an HPA course on me. If he's a psychiatrist, how's that? He can run out of his practices, too. Anyway, I was very interested in these Indian rope tricks and things like that. And the psychiatrists at the St. Elizabeth's, the leading mental hospital in Washington, D.C., they were very interested in what I was doing. The first book had already been published. And it was a warm, warm summer day, beautiful summer day in Washington. And the head of the hospital, he was sane. He insisted on it at all times that he was the sanest man there. See, he was a very sane man. Very sane. And he wasn't going to let his staff listen to this Hubbard. No, sir. They were crazy enough already. So they had to have a meeting out at a beautiful home that was outside the institution, and most of the staff of St. Elizabeth's was there. And I didn't much feel like giving a lecture. I had already talked to several of them before this time, and I had just finished giving a course of five lectures, which were simply introductory lectures, asking people to come in and then go upstairs and get auditing demonstrations by several auditors that we had there. And the psychiatrists never went upstairs and got audited. They just sat there listening to this opening lecture. So I thought, well, this is pretty dull. And I didn't feel that warm summer day like giving a lecture, so the last time that I ever used masked hypnotism was right there. It was a dirty trick. I just told them that they were resting peacefully, and now they had heard a marvelous lecture, and now they could wake up. And they all told me afterwards that it was a marvelous lecture. Yeah. But as the years have gone on, we have multiplied and divided and subtracted and gone forward and fallen on our heads and succeeded and had loses and so on, and by this time we've pretty well got our standard planted the world around. And we have a future, which is pretty good. We have a big future today. And one of our biggest futures is in South Africa, because this country, above all other countries, is in some kind of a situation in order to accept some sanity. The others are pretty far gone. You don't think they're far gone. You spend some time up north for a little while. Golly, I was glad to get back here. Wow. You would just be fascinated at the amount of difficulties they're having in the north. They've got newspapers, that's the first thing. And they've got other things, too. They've got... Well, as far as I can tell, they are trying to fight overpopulation. That's the main thing they're trying to fight. And they're trying to get a political philosophy that takes care of overpopulation. Unfortunately, the best political philosophy on overpopulation happens to be communism. It does. You don't have to worry about the lame, halt, and blind. You don't have to worry about the lazy ones. You don't have to worry about a welfare program or anything else. You just shoot them. When you set up a welfare department in a communist state, you just hand them some Sten guns, and that's it. terrible philosophy, as a matter of fact. It means that you have no beliefs unless the state tells you to have them. And it means, in particular, that you get no wages. A pure communism. Right in Russia today, they've got a capitalism. Don't kid yourselves. They pay wages and they're giving bonuses and everything else. They've just cued and ate with capitalism until they're a capitalistic state. But I'm talking about the communism that's put up forward on East Germany, on China, and that sort of thing. And one of the things that startles your Bantu down here is when he says, "What's this communism?" And I always tell him, "Well, communism, that's a political philosophy that won't permit you to draw any wages." And he... "That a fact?" "Yes, sir, that's a fact. You can't have any wages if you're a communist. You don't get any pay. You work for nothing." Boy, that gets him. That's called a reductio ad absurdum. Quite effective. If you want to tell people at that level what communism is, why, that's a good explanation. But we have our own fight with this, because the communist has his own political mental philosophy. It's called psychopolitics. If a guy doesn't believe in their politics, they drive him psycho. That's right. That's what it is. And he objects to us. He objects to us strenuously. Because what is he going to do? We can undo every trick he's got. One of the best ways he has of forwarding his, quote, political philosophy into the world is by blackmail. He gets things on people, you see, and then he makes them do what he's supposed to do. That's why perversion in a State Department is so fantastically bad. You know, like they happen in the United States and England. Well, that they just get some blackmail on somebody, and then they say, "You do what we say." And then they take somebody that they don't like politically, and they drive him mad with what they call brainwashing. They're not very effective. Brainwashing is a very poor activity. It's a fantastically poor activity. It takes them 70 days to brainwash somebody. And at the end of that time, the individual, the second that you wave a hammer and sickle in front of him, says, "Ark." You see, he says "ark" because it's all Pavlovian. Well, Pavlov's a pretty good chap. There's nothing wrong with him, except they kidnapped him over to the Kremlin. And they made him build atom bombs, and he was so weak-minded that he went ahead and built them, that is to say, mental atom bombs. Did you know that? Did you know that Stalin took Pavlov in the last days of his life, took him into the Kremlin, had him write 400 pages of how the philosophy that applied to dogs could be applied to human beings? Did you know that? And that is the philosophy today on which communism forwards itself into the world. And that type of brainwashing and appeal and stimulus response mechanisms and so on, which were developed at that time, are used by the communist today. And we can undo the whole packet. You put somebody in an auditing chair and put him on an e-meter, and that's the end of all those 70 days. That's the end of all the blackmail. That's the end of it. And when we first emerged upon the world stage, they tried to use us. And they tried to use us very heavily, and we flashed back. First time the communist ever made a bid to me was in 1938 through AMTORG, the American Trading Organization, in the United States. They offered me $200,000 cash and Pavlov's laboratories in order to come to Russia and complete this work, which I am now doing. So don't think they weren't interested. But it's sort of, if we can't have it, we're going to shoot the guys who do. And they've been shooting at us ever since. And someday I want to get together with Khrushchev, and I'm going to say to Khrushchev, "What are you withholding?" One of the things that's delightful about this work is one ceases to take life quite so seriously. Life is a serious proposition, and actually the development of Dianetics and Scientology has been a very serious activity with me for about 11 years, almost finished me off, as a matter of fact, half a dozen times. You wouldn't think that a philosophic activity that has to do with all of the epistemology and the various philosophies of existence and so forth would all get rigged up with highway patrol and space opera and so forth. You wouldn't think so. But Dianetics and Scientology, because it's for real, has gotten mixed up in these things, and thoroughly. Very hard. Very hard. You know, I've been almost on the verge of being kidnapped and put into airplanes and flown half across a continent to be dived out of sight for the rest of my life. And I would have, too, if I hadn't been so good with a 45. I would have. But they don't expect for philosophers to be good with 45s. That's what's peculiar about me. I am not the model philosopher. I'm not even the model saint. I'm not a... You know, a fellow is supposed to be good. You know, he's supposed to have very good behavior, and he's supposed to be this, and he's supposed to be that. And he's supposed to be able to go around with a shepherd's crook or something like that and pat children on the head. I'm not that kind of a fellow. Little kids like me, but they like me because I'm just me. And I'm not the sort of a fellow who tries to capitalize upon my super greatness and my biceps in order to impress you, or the fact that I could put up a couple of vases up here and make them explode in midair and say, see what a Thetan can do, therefore you're better, you better go into propitiation. That'd be a bum deal too, wouldn't it? No, probably the only reason this work ever could have been done in the first place is I've spent quite a bit of time living. And make quite an autobiography, if I ever dared write. That's what my auditors always think when they're auditing me, you know. I process very fast. I get very fast results on processing. But you can see an auditor's hair sort of start to stand on end. And I'm supposed to do this kind of thing, you see. I'm supposed to walk around and set an example. I don't. I like to chase antelope on motorcycles and weird things like that. And philosophers aren't supposed to do that, that's all. You're supposed to sit in an ivory tower and know nothing about life. And if you know absolutely nothing about life, then you've got it made. Then you don't at any time have to be responsible for it being applied to anything. You get the theory? It's like Aristotelian natural history. They tell a story of Aristotelian natural history that goes like this. There was a lecturer in an Aristotelian college back about the 15th century giving a talk to his class on sturgeons. And the sturgeons, of course, were this and that. And, of course, it was all out of Aristotle, you know. Sturgeons. And he was reading it all off. And, of course, there are numerous kinds of sturgeon in the world, but Aristotle never covered these sturgeons, that's all. And a sturgeon walked up to the door and walked in while he was giving the lecture and started to ask a question, and he frowned at the sturgeon. He says, if one of you young gentlemen will put this strange beast out of here, we'll continue the lecture. Not a very good joke, but it's illustrative of the situation. No, you never learn about man by avoiding man. You have to walk with man to know man. You never learn about life by withholding yourself totally from life. If you do hold yourself entirely away from life, and if you are of a frame of mind that keeps you detached from existence, you will always continue to be a slave. You'll be a slave to something. Only if you can live, only if you can freely circulate in existence, only if you can face up to your fellow man, only if you can talk to the beings that exist on the planet you're on at the time, can you have any idea of the reality of existence, or can you form any real opinion of existence. The philosopher who stays in the ivory tower, that chap with his great opinions, can solve all of your problems and all the problems of life with the greatest of ease, on paper or with a slide rule or something like this, because he isn't cluttered up with any data. He isn't stopped by having any facts. He can go on any way he wishes, you see. He's totally unimpeded. He sets up a synthetic man, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Boy, did he set up a synthetic valence that he called man. And look at the ruddy mess. Look at the French Revolution. He was trying to solve the problems of this pastoral creature who did very fine whistling on pan pipes or something like that, or playing with the goats. I don't know what his ideal man was supposed to do, but he wasn't supposed to live. That's fairly sure. So here was this ideal man. And then he did everything so this ideal man could live, only the ideal man didn't exist, and all of his solutions applied not one moment to the rest of mankind. So therefore, it was a mess. You see how this could be? And if I went around trying to solve the problems of an ideal man, you'd be out in the cold. Because you're real. You're alive. You breathe. You hurt. You bleed. You see that? So maybe it was a good thing I've been the sinner that I have been. That's one way of apologizing for it, isn't it? It's very funny when your own overts catch up with you, though. Well, that's very funny. It's very funny also to be audited on your own subject. And you know all about it. Half the auditors you get expect you to sit there in the PC's chair and lecture them, you see, on how they're to audit you. But good auditors don't. They just sit there and audit you. And for an awful long time, I'd had a stuck picture. Every time I'd go past that part of the track, I'd have this stuck picture. And I often figured that overts applied to other people along the lines of war, but they wouldn't apply to me. Some peculiar action here. Because you see, it's all in the name of patriotism, and it's all in the name of this, and it's all in the name of that. But I kept getting this stuck picture. So I said that it couldn't possibly be a stuck picture, and it couldn't possibly be there, because patriotism and so forth dictates that when one fights a war, one kills men. So therefore, a stuck picture of this character, brush it aside. Except every time I went past that part of the time track, the picture stuck. Interesting, isn't it? It was a picture of a sinking Japanese submarine, which I shot down. This becomes very peculiar. Because the picture stuck because I had at one time or another been able to speak Japanese and had been a good friend of the Japs. As a young boy, I'd been friends with the Japs. Then we get into war, and it's all right to shoot down Japs, you see? Only it's not all right to shoot down Japs. They are alive. They exist. They live. And they were fighting for what they thought was right. And we were fighting for what we thought was right. But the funny part of it is, we were fighting. The Chinese, old Chinese Buddhists had a statement for it. I last heard this statement when I was a young boy in the Orient. Big fight going on between two rickshaw boys. Oh, they were in there just fighting, yap, 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 but they weren't hitting each other. They were just standing there, you know, and they're going yap, 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 and they're kind of gesturing with their hands, but they weren't fighting. And I said, what's the matter with those fellows? Chinese friend of mine, an old Captain Wu. He was a junk captain. And he said, oh, he says, he said, the one that strikes the first blow admits that he runs out of ideas. No, the Orient is the Orient. And I spent a long time out there, And when I got back and looked at the West, I spent a long time with Western philosophies. And somewhere between the two, there might have been some truths, but as far as I could find out, I didn't find anybody who would admit to it. They were either all for the West or all for the East. And the people who were in the West said everybody who was in the East were all wrong, and the people who were in the East said everybody in the West was all wrong. That's interesting, isn't it? Well, you know, I don't think either of them were right. There was that old stuck picture of mine. I think it's wrong not to examine the realities of the situation. So I've done quite a bit of living in my day. I've had to. I've lived amongst 12 primitive cultures, eaten lizard's tails, and said I liked them. Now, looking over the realities of existence, we have to have the solution to the things that are, not the things we hope are. We have to live the life which is there to be lived, not the life we hope one should live. Nearly everybody's on a huge ought to be. You know, everybody runs this ought to be on me. You know, they never look at me as I am, they look at me as I ought to be. And when I slip from grace just about that far, I remember the first time I ever got mad in a foundation meeting, in the early days, and I got mad. And having red hair, I can get very mad. And about three fellows went white, and they rushed out of the room. And then later I found one of them looking sad and heartbroken. He says, but I always looked upon you as being a serene, you know, big ought to be. Big ought to be. You mean because you do work of this character, you're no longer permitted to get mad? What kind of an operation is this? You mean because you do work of this nature, you're no longer permitted to live or breathe or like ice cream? You mean you can no longer get in trouble? You mean you've always got to go around walking on eggs for fear of what people will think? I would think to me that's pretty aberrated. And yet there's some of you Scientologists doing that this very minute. You're walking around very carefully. What will people think? Why don't you run it? You're the ones who know what people think. Now, why worry about what they think? There's no point in it. People think what they think, that's what they think. And they're pretty cotton pick and hypercritical, too. You know, we get into very grooved channels of thought about some things. I remember up in the Arctic one time, I was on an expedition. One of the natives that was loading some barges kept just sitting off to the side, not helping his fellow natives, you know, just sitting off to the side and doing nothing. And pretty soon, I heard one of them call him a rawr, whatever it was. Nobody can learn this Eskimo tongue. It's a very rough tongue. And he called him a rah rah. Well, I'd heard myself call a rah rah too, so I was very, very curious, you see. Well, of course, the white man always has a very lordly idea of how he's regarded by the lesser races. You know, he's, after all, the commanding race, and so on. But they were calling me a rah rah, and calling him a rah rah too didn't sit well. So I put the foreman of this crew in a brace, and I said, what does that mean? Oh, he said, he's lazy, he's no good. And I said, well, what is your word for being lazy and no good? And he says, white man. So in the course of one's researches, one doesn't necessarily have to learn humility. But he very definitely should have a fairly thick skin. A 11 years Dianetics and Scientology has been on the road. That's a long time. In actual development, it has taken 30 years. From the first days that I was measuring up poetry on a Kinnick photometer. The only shock about that was to go over to the psychology department and find out that they didn't know anything about mental reactions from a mechanical basis or from a representative basis. They had their own ideas. Undoubtedly, they were doing fine, but they couldn't tell me anything about it. As a matter of fact, they were very cross with me. They said, "You are from the engineering department, I believe." And I said, "That's right." They said, "And you are experimenting with mental phenomena, is that correct?" I said, "That's right." And they said, "Don't you realize that that is the total prerogative of psychology?" And I said, "That's wrong." But I found out that they couldn't answer this basic question of, do all races have certain reactions to certain stimuli and response? Well, from there, I wanted to find the world's or the tiniest particle of energy. And as near as I could find out, it must be in the human mind. If energy wasn't terribly tiny, there was nothing you could record memory on. And I figured out one time all about how you recorded memories if you use punched protein molecules. And I found out that 21 or 10 to the 21st power binary digits of neurons, it's some fabulous figure. If you wrote that up here, it'd just go back and forth with zeros, you see. And I said, well, if you've got that many and you file 10 memories or 20 memories, or let's be very liberal, let's say 100 memories to each molecule, how much memory would you have? And I figured it out, how many things a man perceived in a single day and how many things he could potentially remember, and I found out he only had 3 months' worth of memory. So according to any finite theory of memory, as it existed in the mechanical or existing world of that day, 1932, you are totally incapable of remembering anything that happened further than 3 months ago. So you might as well just not try. But I didn't stay in the ivory tower and say, well, that's it. Mankind can't remember anything longer than 3 months ago. I went around and tried to find some people who could remember longer than that. I didn't really start striking the jackpot until about 1946 and 47. I found that people could remember birth. And then a little later than that, I found out they could remember before birth. And then after that, why, excited everybody's incredulity, because I found that people could remember all the way back. As a matter of fact, I was talking to an Apache Indian one day, asking him how far he could remember back, and he said, well, his memory got pretty dim just before the, along about the time of the Crook activities out there, when he was fighting General Crook. And look, this fellow, he's about 21, you know. And Crook, that was back in about 1879. Yeah, he's, by your time. I was an old man then. He didn't know anything about Scientology, you see. He didn't know anything about pastimes. And here he was talking to me along this line. And I said, well, you've ever told anybody that you can remember clear back then? He said, nobody ever asked me. So, this gets kind of ridiculous. How far back can you remember? Actually, I was not monkeying around in the dark. I myself was already aware of the fact that I was getting amnesia. I couldn't remember some of the spots where I'd been and some of the things I was doing, which was my only concern about myself. In plotting out the existence of man, however, I found it was necessary to lay out a whole observable routine activity which was true of all men, not true of whites or true of Chinese or Martians or something, but it had to be true of everybody. In other words, if this cap was a true cap, then it had to fit all heads, you see? And that has been the main difficulty. There has never been any slightest doubt about being able to take one case, study one case, and resolve one case for me. But to tell an auditor over here, a Scientologist, to do so-and-so, and it would solve all of his cases, oh, that was something else. To this day, actually, psychiatrists aren't mad at me personally. They're not. They're not. You ask them over in the States and so forth, and they say, well, Hubbard has a touch. They believe in this, you see. He has a feeling, you know, and he is able to look into minds and do something about it. But he shouldn't teach other people to do it. That, you see, is where I'm wrong. It must all be a mystery. Now, I'll tell you, if everybody keeps the mind a mystery from here on out, there'll just be more atom bombs blowing up. If the mind remains a mystery, then man will remain unhappy. In the lands of the greatest mysteries, I found the greatest unhappiness. In the areas of the world where all was a mystery and nobody was in communication at all, everybody was starving to death and falling on their heads. So we have to assume that in those areas where there's the greatest enlightenment, we would have the greatest happiness. And it's true. If man wishes to be happy, if man wants to be happy, then man will have to be able to know. He'll have to know something about his present, his potentialities, his future, and so forth. But basically, he'd have to know something about himself. This fantastic thing happened on this planet. Man was here. Man was struggling along. Man was trying to get along with his fellows. He was trying to resolve his problems. He'd get on two sides of the fence. Each side knew it was absolutely right, while neither side was right. And he would become very unhappy. Why? How would you like to be a mechanic working on a radio set if you didn't know what it was supposed to do? Wouldn't that be an interesting thing? Here's a radio set. You don't even know it's supposed to receive. You don't know it's supposed to be hooked up to the mains. Don't know anything about it, and you're supposed to repair it. Well, that was the lot of the early witch doctor. He was trying to fix radio sets that he knew nothing about. He had no parts list and no guarantee. This is silly, you see, trying to do things in life about which people know nothing. How can you do anything at all for a human being mentally if you do not know anything about a human being? Well, that'd be kind of a silly activity, wouldn't it? Well, what I ran into was a zone of not knowingness as far as man was concerned, and I went forward into that zone of not knowingness, and through storm, rain, night, and riding the lightning, managed to blaze a small path that a man could go through. Now, existence has not been easy doing that because a lot of fellows don't want to be known. And when you get around and really get the society classified amongst the ducks and the drakes and that sort of thing, you will find there's an awful lot of fellows left over in this pile that they don't want anything known about them at all. In fact, if you knew anything about them, you would, of course, have to hang them, and that would be unpleasant. So the best way they protect you, of course, is by not letting you know anything about them. So for a long time, we still had this segment of fellows over here that didn't want anything known about themselves. And we finally found out why they didn't want anything known about themselves and how to crack through that fact and how to get them on the road too. And we found out they really didn't want to remain a mystery. They just didn't think anything could be done about it. They were afraid something might be done about it if that meant they were going to have their throats cut from ear to ear. So in existence, we have gradually gone out in further and further perimeters, taken in more and more territory, understood more and more about man, more and more about things. We finally are working with processes now which reach all men and which work rather well. But in order to do that, we had to know something about the anatomy of the human mind. Now, somebody goofed when they put together some of the earlier studies, the Asclepian in ancient Greece, various temples of healing in Rome, the witchcraft, the witches who were driven out by the medicos from Europe, the priests, later day, well, the faculty psychologists of the 16th century, the various schools which have come forward since, the alienists and the psychiatrists and the psychologists and so forth. All of these fellows were up against something. They were looking at a radio set they didn't have a parts list for. And not having a parts list, they of course couldn't establish very much of what parts were missing or what were awry. Now, I don't mean to decry these fellows. I feel sorry for them. Because I'll tell you, the most dangerous thing in the world is to know a little bit about the human mind. If you start a forward activity of trying to find out about the human mind and all the answers aren't available, you are liable to be in danger. That I can tell you after all these years. You have to know all about it. That doesn't necessarily apply to you personally, because now somebody knows about it, providing you make sure the information doesn't get lost. But it means that in any early study of it, there are so many booby traps. There are so many condensers which have 5,000 volts in them in this machine that probing around at random with a screwdriver is adventurous. Not knowing several things about the mind, of course, made a horrible mess of earlier subjects. One of the first and foremost things, psychology knew about the stimulus response mechanism. You hit somebody and he flinches. Your stimuli response. They knew this. That was one of the primary data they had. But you know that's not all there is to it. They hit, they flinch, they hit. It's the overt motivator sequence. That which he attacks you. Wow. Think of these poor psychiatrists attacking insane people continuously on and on and on, attacking insanity without knowing how to do anything about insanity. Think of those fellows. What adventurousness. What a fantastic thing to do. And yet they noticed that after they attacked insanity for a while, they went into the spin bins themselves. No, it's very dangerous not to know your stuff in the human mind. The only overt, by the way, which a Scientologist can probably pull is to fail to disseminate the information. If you look it over carefully, you'll see that is the primary overt. And not to misaudit a PC. Not to get messed up somehow or another. Not to set a good example of being clear. Those are not overts. Fail to disseminate the information correctly is an overt. It's an overt of magnitude. Why? Well, the information's been found. It exists. It's there to disseminate. And if it isn't disseminated correctly, people put themselves back into the same category as they were before. But they have a half-known subjects. Now, what do you think Buddhism became? It became a half-known subject. I have no doubt but what Gautama Siddhartha knew far more than we know about Buddhism. See, it's a half-known subject. You know, he could blow out of his head and do interesting things. He could. We know why today, and we can do it at our peril. Silly thing to do, go blowing out of your head. We've got a perfectly good body, you know. We can do all of the things and explain all the things that Buddhists were doing, amongst other things. We're not just concentrating on that area. But I'm just explaining to you, here was a half-known Here was possibly a very wide zone of knowledge, which probably was resident with one man, and then less and less of it got known. And it eventually disappeared. Now, I'm not even comparing us with Buddhism, but I'm just giving you a good example of that. And now, if you study Buddhism, you've practically had it. You start meditating for a while and concentrating upon your navel. Next thing you know, you become the stable datum amidst all that confusion that is a bank. And you don't quite know what happened to you, but you spin. You blow somebody out of his head today, and he gets a re-stim. Just talking Scientologies, he gets upset. Yet the Buddhists did it all the time. And you start exteriorizing without knowing Scientology, and you've had it. Because there's no patching up the exteriorization. It keys in death. And a fellow, after he's been exteriorized, goes around wondering if he isn't dead, really. No, knowledge, if you've got it, you've got it. And it's dangerous not to know everything there is to know about the human mind. I find this out after I've been walking along the edges of cliffs, you know, and gazing down explosive atomic retorts and looking into feverish brains and looking at blondes. I find out it's dangerous. I don't lead a charmed life. I lead a lucky one. So we've come out at the other end with the information. And we've got all the information. And if the portions of it which are still to be known are explicable or undoable by what we already know. You understand? We know enough now to get out of trouble if we get into trouble knowing more. You got it? And that's a very fortuitous spot to be in, and I think it's the first time man has been in that spot. Now, basically, this information is wide information. It is not secret information. It is not a mystery. There is no vested interest in hugging it to our bosoms. We are not owned by anyone. We are the only free people left on earth. We have information. By that information, we can get free. We have an existence before us. We can do pretty well with it what we like. Nobody's going to tell us what to do with it. So therefore, I'm very glad to talk to you here in South Africa today. These first opening remarks I'm making are rather random to you, because we've got to get down to business now in the next hour. I haven't got time to loaf around on this. But I want to say hello to each and every one of you. I'm very glad you are here. I consider it a privilege to be able to talk to you today. And thank you for turning out so marvelously. Thank you.